President of the United States has two wars on his hand, and he is desperately trying to figure a way out of both of them. The one that we started in Iran, and then the one that his predecessor basically started in Ukraine against Russia. But now it's President Trump's. It's on his table, and he's got to try to figure it out because that's going in a decided bad direction, which could see it escalate into a NATO clash with Russia. How is President Trump going to navigate these two very, very complex missions? Of course, diplomacy is the best answer because there is no military solution to either one of them. If that's what we think is the solution, we're in even bigger trouble than any of us realize, because President Trump is now, I think that you have to say, is cognitively impaired, and I don't know how we're going to get through this. And in case you think I'm being hyperbole, we're going to show you some things during this show today that make a pretty sober case for it. And to help us navigate that, we have back with us after an absence of a while on our show is Ambassador Chaz Freeman, who, of course, used to be in the minister or used to be an assistant secretary of defense, also was in the State Department, was an ambassador at Saudi Arabia, and is, in my view, one of the best foreign policy voices in America today. Mr. Ambassador, welcome back to our show.
Thank you, Danny. Good to be back.
Well, listen, I wish it was almost like, hey, let's just reminisce about the good old days when there was used to be a lot of intellectual heft in Washington, D.C., and we did some really strong diplomatic work and worked through some very challenging things. The 1972 trip to China might be a good one to talk about, which you yourself had some role in. Unfortunately, we have what we have, and let's just start with the ugly stuff up front that we can't bypass. President Trump went on Truth Social about an hour or so ago and was making some pretty strange claims about China and Russia and saying that they're not going to support the Ukraine, Iran in its war against us. Gary, if you can toss that one up there. And he uses some pretty curious justification for this claim by saying, hey, and by the way, I don't know if you knew. Let's see, Gary, if you can highlight that part in the middle there. Because Xi Jinping understands that I do not sell weapons to Ukraine, but to NATO countries. They pay full price, and how those weapons are distributed, I have no idea. Therefore, those two major countries basically cannot do anything to help Iran. If they do, there's going to be a big problem. But holy cow, Gary, do we still have that one for Rubio up? Do we still have that one handy?
We remain ready to play any role we can in that context of bringing a peace about, because we think the war in Ukraine, devastating war, has no military solution. It can only be solved through a diplomatic route, and it's been unfruitful. I would characterize it as the ongoing challenges. That said, let's be clear, we are not, to be fair and to be frank, we are not impartial mediators in that war. Okay, we don't provide weapons to Russia. We only provide weapons to Ukraine. We don't impose sanctions on Ukraine. We only impose sanctions on Russia. So we have clearly taken a side. We continue to sell weapons to Ukraine, by the way, through the Pearl program, unimpeded by what's happened in the Middle East or anywhere else. And look, we'd love to see that come to a negotiated settlement. As of right now, the prospects don't look great.
So here you see, he categorically says we sell weapons to Ukraine through the Pearl program, which is through NATO. And then here today, President Trump says this. I just got to ask, what do you make of that?
Well, it reminds me of a famous song by Tom Lehrer. I don't know if you remember him. He was an MIT mathematician who was a musical genius. And he had a song about Wernher von Braun. And he said, I just send the rockets up. I don't know where they come down, said Wernher von Braun. I mean, this is absurd, obviously. And as far as Secretary Rubio's statement is concerned, these weapons must be fictitious because we're out of them. Our magazine depth is way, way down. We don't have the stuff to sell to Ukraine that we once did through Europeans. We're depleting it as we speak. We had 13 nights of bombing of Iran, which are running down the stocks even more. So this is basically incoherent, like our policy, and not credible, like our policy, and self-contradictory, like our policy, and it's going nowhere.
And what then is that going to leave us? If there is no diplomacy, and even that from June 4th from Secretary Rubio, even then he's talking about, well, we don't really see a path to a negotiated settlement with Russia because we have jettisoned and rejected all the diplomacy. Even in this case here with Iran, I didn't think we could get it, but on the 26th of February, so 2 days before we started the war with Omani mediation, they had agreed, the Iranians had agreed to terms and to negotiate and talk about stuff like their support to their proxies, like their long-range missile programs. They were at least willing to talk about that, which they hadn't up to that time, and they were going to give something better even in, with no enrichment and no reprocessed material, stuff that I didn't think they could give. They had it on the table then, and we threw that away too. Therefore, with not just the lies that get us into the 2025 war and the 2026 war, the rejection of all this diplomacy, where does that leave us now?
As well as the Palestinians and others have concluded there's no point in talking to us because we don't know how to negotiate. I think that's ironic. We have a president who had a ghostwritten book called The Art of the Deal. He's very good at transactional bullying. He does not know how to reach agreement with someone who has strong convictions and resists. And so we've had a complete failure to do anything about the Ukraine war except alienate the Ukrainians and our European allies, hand the bag to them. And there was a meeting at Anchorage, which the Russians thought that there had been some understandings reached. They were very pleased. There was no follow-up. Why was there no follow-up? Because the government has stripped itself of its competence. There's nobody in the room to take notes. There's nobody to follow up. There is no implementation of what is apparently agreed. In fact, no one can even remember or describe what has been agreed in any of these meetings. We have two envoys, Kushner and Witkoff, who are notorious for their absolute incompetence. They've not accomplished a thing, not in any context, unless you count the so-called Board of Peace in Gaza as a success. I mean, that is basically, it was conceived as an effort to build a resort on a cemetery full of dead Palestinians. And it is now being used. The Israelis are building a wall in Gaza to take 70% of the territory, leave 30% for the remaining Palestinians to be concentrated in. So what was a concentration camp on October 6th, a couple of years ago, is now being turned into a prison in one small part of Gaza. And nobody's kicked into the Board of Peace. So all of this stuff is fake. Talk about fake news. How about fake diplomacy? Diplomacy used to justify and conceal in the intention to conduct a surprise attack, as February 26 illustrated. February 28, we attacked with we murdered the entire upper echelon of the Iranian leadership, including the father of the current leader, his wife, his daughter, his niece, his son-in-law, and we're expecting him to feel conciliatory and want to sit down and talk to us? No. The Iranians have decided that there's no point in talking to us. They're going to see this through militarily, and so are the Russians. We have so blotted our copybook diplomatically that we lack credibility with everyone. We even have a story in the Washington Post yesterday about how the Europeans prepared to go to war with us over Greenland. I mean, we're just flailing around pointlessly. And I just make a last comment about what's going on in the Persian Gulf. This is pointless violence, not directed at any negotiation. The assumption, which is completely bogus, is that if you hit the Iranians hard enough, they will capitulate. Well, we've hit them very hard for a long time. Do they show any signs of capitulating? And we don't report our own casualties, of course, the Iranians are actually producing a lot of satellite footage that shows that they're being very effective in hitting our bases, removing us from the Persian Gulf, pushing us back in the direction of Israel. And I bet they can't wait for us to concentrate there. That'll be the denouement, the last move in this game. They get us all concentrated in one place and then hit the hell out of us. So this is all military and no diplomacy at all.
I mean, I think you can make the argument that we are literally self-destructing with President Trump at the helm, and we're going to see he's got some enablers here in a second. But let's take a look at one more thing, because this was posted just right before we came on the air here about this continued spat that the president has with Canada. Canada disinvited the United States of America, the opening of the Gordie Howe Bridge. And apparently Trump does not take any kind of perceived slight very well, which is fine, considering they are paying substantial tariffs, which he has just tossed new tariffs on Canada here just a couple of days ago. But the original deal on the bridge, which was terribly negotiated by a previous administration, no longer stands. We changed the terms of the deal so that the United States of America now gets 50%, whatever. So this harkens back and shows a continued degradation, even in working with our close friends, is that, hey, if I don't like a term like the JCPOA in 2018, I'll just get out of it. Here now, even something with our closest ally, I don't like this term, so I'm just going to make up some new ones, and you're just going to have to suck them down. What do you make of this?
Well, unfortunately, this is standard operating procedure in this administration. I understand that the Canadians paid for the bridge. We didn't. And the Trump administration wanted to split the tolls. And of course, the Canadians did not agree. And now we're changing the terms of the agreement. Well, we just did the same thing with the alleged nuclear agreement with Saudi Arabia, which was full of all sorts of problems. It really had no restriction on reprocessing uranium. It was not consistent with other agreements that we've made. One assumes that the reason we made this agreement is to essentially bribe the Saudis into continuing to cooperate with us militarily against Iran. But in fact, they're not being very cooperative for their own reasons. And immediately after the agreement was signed, Donald Trump says, well, here's an additional condition. It can't go into effect unless Saudi Arabia normalizes with Israel. Well, the polls in Saudi Arabia show 97-98% of the population completely opposed to any normalization with Israel, given its behavior. So was all this a feint by Donald Trump? Get the Saudis back to help us deliver the alleged knockout blow on Iran that he says we're about to deliver? No, I don't think so. I think it was confusion. I don't think he knew what was in the agreement. He has misdescribed it publicly. If you read what we know about what's in the agreement, it has nothing to do with what Donald Trump says. And now he's basically queered the thing with his introduction of the normalization requirement with Israel. What that basically does is tell Israel, first, he's willing to sell out their interests by doing a deal that they can't accept and that they consider menacing to them. He's just told the Iranians that he isn't serious about safeguards on their reprocessing, because if he can do it for Saudi Arabia, why can't he do it for them? He's just hardened their position. He's offended the United Arab Emirates, where we insisted on a no reprocessing clause in the agreement, which we didn't in the case of Saudi Arabia. And he's unnerved everybody in the region, because everybody understands that if Iran goes nuclear, Saudi Arabia will go nuclear. So will Turkey. So will Egypt. The Iranians understand that. And that's probably the only reason they haven't gone nuclear, because they don't want to be surrounded by a bunch of other nuclear powers. Their security situation would not be improved by that. It would be worsened. In the meantime, Israel, of course, remains the only nuclear power, clandestinely developed nuclear power, in the region. And it's really a miracle that the Israeli development of nuclear weapons in the way they did and the way they talk about them has not caused everybody else in the region already to go nuclear. But Donald Trump has just shredded our nonproliferation policy, which goes back to JFK and, you know, a long time ago. I think he's probably unnerved the entire world about our ability to understand issues, to be consistent in our policy, and to consider the interests of others as well as the interests of Donald Trump.
And that's why I'm arguing that there is a serious problem here, because it's one thing if you're just, I'll just be blunt, if you're an idiot or if you're ignorant and you just don't know. But this seems more like there's something wrong cognitively with how the plans are going on. Whether he knew or didn't know what was in that deal, he just unilaterally changed it here with no concept of all of the ramifications, which you just talked about here. And I think you can make the argument that was the same.
You've frozen.
Which would have given him an out to get out of this problem, because now then the strait would have been opened up. But then in the very first part of this, 7 days in the Strait of Hormuz, paragraph 5, which unequivocally said that Iran gets to decide for 60 days how that's going to be done. And then Iran and Oman will figure it out from that point forward. No role whatsoever for the U.S. We add in the Southern Corridor, Oman, that starts this whole problem, et cetera, that never needed to happen. So that directly contradicted our own interests, contradicted what President Trump himself signed. So that shows that there is literally no one that he won't sabotage on a deal.
No, that's right. And I think the Iranians have explicitly said that they regard his signature as valueless, completely insignificant, and not worth attempting to achieve. And this just underscores the point that we've convinced the entire world that we don't know what we're doing, and we can't be trusted, and we don't keep our word, and we don't even stay consistent from one day to the next. So how can you deal with us? That's the question everybody has out there. You know, when you were talking about idiots and so forth, I was recalling a paraphrase from Mark Twain, who said, suppose you were an idiot. Suppose you were Donald Trump. Oh, I repeat myself.
Yeah. And you mentioned the Iranian side here. This is from Foreign Minister Araghchi. He said, Iran has shown that it will not submit to America's bullying, and we will by no means respond to the language of force, pressure, and threats. We neither fear threats nor bow to pressure, and we will not tolerate the language of threats. And it continued on after that. But actually, Professor Morandi has said the same thing on our show in the past, that they don't trust anything. In fact, I remember before the MOU was signed, he was also saying, because of everything that had happened up to that point, that they didn't have any trust in it. And that's, he said, that's why they're still willing to go to negotiations as long as we have some confidence building measures and give something up front, which was the reduction of the energy sanctions and the release of the frozen funds. The sanctions went off for a few days. Then we threw them back on and added some more. We never released the frozen funds nor anything else that we had in there. So even now, just help me as best you can understand. If you're on the Iranian side, or maybe what you know from them, given how the whole MOU situation disintegrated and fell apart, upon what basis can they even now enter into this alleged proposal for a new 10-day ceasefire to try to get something else back? Is there any reason why they would even attempt to do that?
No, of course not, because they understand that that is would be a respite, an opportunity for us to get our forces in place to attack them again. That's how they interpret it. And, you know, we have approached Iran not for negotiations, but in much the way that a mafia protection racket approaches someone. You know, nice little country, civilization you have here. Boy, it would be really too bad if we had to destroy it. And you better do what we're going to say, what we say. You better do what we want, or we're just going to keep blasting you. We're going to shoot you. And we have, you know, there's a certain one-sidedness here. You know, I lament the death of American service people in Jordan, at least 4. Of course, the figures are entirely fictitious that the Pentagon puts out. They have managed to obscure the number of deaths and wounded thoroughly. But, you know, all of this is very sad. But my God, there have been thousands of deaths on the Iranian side. Where do we get off? You know, you start a war of aggression and you lose 18 people, now down to 14, because they, same day that Donald Trump received the corpses of the 4 dead from Jordan, the Pentagon redefined the criteria and removed 4 of the, removed those 4 from the list of
reprehensible.
Dead. Absolutely reprehensible. So if you are looking at this, where's the element of honesty that you can bank on? Where's the trust that you can count on? If I say I'm going to do something and I don't, not only don't do it, but the next time, next minute, do something totally contradictory, like, you know, shooting up a place, what, after saying I wouldn't, you know, how can you deal with me? And I, you know, Danny, it's not only is the style of this administration self-destructive, but they have gutted our diplomatic capacity. The Department of State has been gutted. Marco Rubio claims to be the Secretary of State, but he's not behaving that way. He's also the National Security Advisor, but he doesn't coordinate policy, which is what the National Security Council is supposed to do. The remaining staff there seem to be all engaged in cover-your-ass operations politically, domestically, rather than accomplishing anything overseas. He's the National Archivist, but nobody writes anything down anymore, so there aren't any archives being produced. And I guess he's the head of USAID, we've just discovered would have been quite helpful dealing with things like Ebola in Africa, which is totally out of control. All the safeguards that we built so carefully over decades were stripped away. This administration began with an assault on government institutions through DOGE, which reminds me, as someone with a lot of experience with China, of nothing so much as the great proletarian cultural revolution, except this was the great plutocratic cultural revolution. Billionaires who didn't have any idea what they were doing, smashing up stuff. And we're paying a price for that everywhere, domestically, in internationally, in terms of our relations with great powers. Do you think Xi Jinping trusts Donald Trump? You think he thinks we have a competent government that could actually implement an agreement in a consistent and reliable fashion? I don't think so. And I know that Vladimir Putin does not believe that. And I know that Mujtaba Khamenei does not believe that. And I'm not sure even the Israelis have any idea of that. We just sold them out on the nuclear front, in their view. And what does that tell them about our reliability? Are we an ally, or are we intent on implementing Henry Kissinger's famous remark that to be an enemy of the United States is a problem, but to be a friend could be lethal, fatal?
Yeah, and, you know, honestly, I think that the Israelis basically committed or created a Frankenstein monster, because I think they were gleefully happy when President Trump fell for all the nonsense that Netanyahu told him in the first year or whatever of his second term here, and got him to go ahead and go into the war, first in the Operation Midnight Hammer, and then now in this one. And now all of a sudden, okay, well, we got there, or well, they haven't gotten it over the line yet, but they have this section, I think 219, and I forget the other one, where they're going to tie the U.S. military and intelligence. I think now, tell me what you think, I think now the Israelis are going, let's just survive Donald Trump, and then we'll get back to business as usual, but we'll have more hooks in the meat.
Bezalel Smotrich just said, he said, well, we don't want any part of this war. You know, let the Americans and the Iranians fight. We're going to, you know, continuing doing what we're doing, which is trying to annex southern Lebanon and parts of Syria and evict all the Palestinians from the West Bank and squeeze the Palestinians in Gaza down into a prison complex called a humanitarian city. That's what they call it. And no, I think everybody is just counting the days and hoping that some consistency will be restored by the midterm elections, but we don't know what's going to happen in those elections.
We got to get to them first. If I can just be blunt here, yeah, this is the mentality of the guy who's calling the shots. We just shown you specifically some of the statements that he's made and the deals that he's undone, et cetera. Like, that probably is enough by itself. But here's how I think, Ambassador, this is what he actually thinks. I no longer just reflexively say he's just saying this because he wants to spread a narrative. I'm starting to believe he believes stuff like this.
We're doing very well against the Islamic Republic of Iran. We're doing extremely well. They would like to do something, but I say they're not ready yet. They need more of the same. They're not ready yet. They got some evil intentions. We cannot let them have a nuclear weapon.
He says they're not ready yet for negotiations, so we need to keep hitting them more. How do you react to that?
Well, I think the nuclear weapon is not the issue now. The issue is the Strait of Hormuz, the health of the American and the global economy. As for the nuclear weapon, we just wiped out everybody in the Iranian leadership who was against it. I think we have made the Iranian development of a nuclear weapon inevitable. They agreed not to do it for 60 days under the so-called Memorandum of Understanding, which it should have been called the Memorandum of Misunderstanding. But we never honored any of that. That memorandum said no threats of use of force, no uses of force. We immediately broke that in both cases. It said we had to get the Israelis out of Lebanon. We made no effort to do that. In fact, we turned around and Marco Rubio went and negotiated an agreement with the powerless government of Lebanon, a ceasefire with Israel. Well, it wasn't fighting Israel. You know, there's the famous question which people ask about the French. You know, how many Frenchmen does it take to defend Paris? And the answer is nobody knows. They've never tried. Well, in the case of Lebanon, how many Lebanese army people does it take to defend Lebanon? Nobody knows. They've never tried. The people who are fighting for Lebanon are Hezbollah. And we just did an agreement with, brokered an agreement between the Lebanese government and Israel that they will jointly go after Hezbollah. So what is this? It is, at a minimum, not very smart.
And at a maximum, it's very, very damaging. You know, here's what's going to compound the situation here. It's not just President Trump. And if it was just him, then there might be some light at the end of the tunnel. But unfortunately, he has a lot of enablers. Let me just show you a couple of them here. This is Jack Keane trying to say, hey, let's just finish the job, man.
Started the operation February 28th. They shut the straits down on March the 2nd. And after living with that for a month, prices started to move up the spiral. For certainly huge economic and political implications of all of it. The president and his team felt the Iranians were sincere about wanting this to negotiate. And we began a series of negotiations that lasted over 90 days. And even came up with a signed agreement referred to as a Memorandum of Understanding, which had only one agreement in it. Everything else was a promise for the future after 60 or so days of negotiation. The one agreement was Iran would open up the Straits of Hormuz and remove all their interference and restrictions. The United States would remove its blockade. We removed the blockade. Several days later, the Iranians began to interfere with the Straits of Hormuz.
So that's a pretty creative interpretation of things. Exactly. I'm pretty sure there were 14 points in there, and I think there wasn't just one for the United States. What do you think of it?
You know, I think that's a complete distortion to the extent there was any agreement at all. Basically, the Memorandum of Understanding, as is the usual case, was not an agreement about anything except a statement of intent to continue a negotiation. And during that period of negotiation, Iran was to manage the shipping in the Strait of Hormuz without imposing tolls or fees. They didn't do that. We then began to try to insert ourselves into the situation. And Donald Trump actually eventually said, we will run the Strait of Hormuz and we'll charge everybody 20% of the value of the cargo. Well, faced with that choice, everybody would opt for Iran, which was proposing a very modest fee structure. I think we have a problem with people like General Keane, others, sycophants around the president. I don't even know whether he's aware of whether the military have had the courage to speak to him directly about the huge damage we're doing to our ability to respond to contingencies around the world. You know, I mean, Everybody for years has said we should pivot to Asia regarding China as the principal challenge to our global position. And we should reduce our presence in West Asia, the Middle East. We're doing the opposite, absolute opposite. Not only are we doing the opposite, but we're ensuring that if there is a Taiwan contingency, we will not be able to respond effectively to it. And we don't have any weapons to transfer to Ukraine through this mechanism of getting Europeans to do that for us, so we can claim we're not involved somehow. I mean, we put, as a country, when we sell a weapon to somebody, we put restrictions on it. You can't retransfer that without our permission. You know, so we are basically at war with the Russians, and they think so, and they know that the European Union and NATO, European members, are actively at war with them, and they know that Ukraine is striking deep into their territory with weapons, which in some cases were purposely designed by Western Europeans to accomplish that. I think the British in particular designed a couple of long-range weapon systems for Ukraine. And we're somehow imagining that the Russians won't eventually be driven into a reprisal of some sort or a counterattack. You know, you don't have to fire a missile at something to destroy it. There are such things as sabotage. There are fifth columns. There are special forces. I remember very well during my time as ambassador to Saudi Arabia, when we were both in the theater, that we were very concerned about Saddam Hussein bringing a biological weapon, anthrax, into Saudi Arabia. There was actually an intelligence report that two Iraqi jets carrying anthrax were intercepted over the Persian Gulf and shot down. But then it occurred to me, hey, you don't need a jet to deliver anthrax. You can use a camel. You know, you can use a suitcase. You don't need to go high tech. So I think that we're really playing with an expansion of the war in Europe that could be very, very destructive and dangerous before we even get to the point that people are, there's a lot of loose talk about nuclear weapons in various contexts. Tactical nuclear weapons to use against China, nuclear weapons of some sort by the Russians to be used against whoever in Western Europe or Ukraine. You know, this is all getting out of control. We've lost our minds. And the reason for that, I think, is that we have a president, we have a leadership in this country that no longer knows what it's doing and is, frankly, out of its mind in terms of its calculations. You keep hitting somebody. I suppose there may be one or two people in a schoolyard. If you hit them enough, they're cowardly and they run away. But for the most part, you hit people, they get angry and they hit back. And that is exactly the dynamic that we have set up all over the place. And the mafia style protection racket that we're trying to run doesn't work.
And let me ask you a question. Since you used to be a senior official in both the Pentagon and in the State Department, you've kind of got, you know, both sides of this view of physical experience in this. It's if we're just talking about President Trump and he's losing his cognitive ability, as I said a second ago, that's alarming. But how can you account for something like what I'm about to show you here when someone who was a former three-star general, a former division commander for the 82nd Airborne, no doubt, no less, and was also the vice president's national security advisor in the first Trump term, saying stuff like General Kellogg does here.
The president wrote a great book a few years ago called Art of the Deal. One of the things he mentioned when you get to negotiations, you get to peace, is the use of leverage. And how do we get leverage over them right now? It is a theocratic regime. They have caused the deaths of Americans. That's the reason I've said you got to take something like Karg Island, which is 90% of their economy, or Larak Island, which is a command and control in the Strait of Hormuz as well. It's not because I think it's great to go and get into a fight, because I've been there and I know what it means. But the fact is, I want to give the president leverage. So you get to a point where you're going to break their back, not only militarily, which we have done, and the senator was right about that, but basically break their back economically as well. And then you can help the Iranian people rise up. We're not going to invade Iran. We shouldn't invade Iran. we should probably help them when they arise.
Back again to this whole thing that the Iranian people are going to rise up. I don't know how that came back in, but holy cow, we're going to take Karg Island. I mean, has he even looked at a map? I mean, if he was a second lieutenant, I would say, man, you got some serious problems here. But I mean, how does he think that's going to affect leverage in negotiations when he's talking about something that militarily would be suicidal for our side?
Well, I remember Foreign Minister Araghchi of Iran saying, y'all come, we're waiting for you. You know, I mean, this would be a bloodbath. If you look at where Karg Island is, which is way up the Persian Gulf and off the coast of Kuwait and Iran, anybody who goes there and occupies that is a sitting duck, even if you can get there. I suppose 82nd Airborne, you do an airdrop on Karg Island. I bet that would be fun. I wonder, that strikes me as utter military incompetence, plus a ridiculous interpretation of who has leverage. Yeah, there you are. I mean, look at that. Iran is to the right, the big landmass there. You're out in the middle of nowhere. This is militarily illiterate, but it's also a complete misunderstanding of the situation. We have destroyed Iran's military. Well, then how the hell are they using the 1,000 miles of coastline they have with the Persian Gulf to control the shipping? You know, what is it that we think we've done?
Here's our bases that have been hit, apparently, by this destroyed military.
Well, exactly. And they're still being hit. And it appears that while we're running out of ammo and interception capability, the Iranians have not begun to do so. They have retained a great deal of their original arsenal. They're also manufacturing underground. And so we're depleting our weapons, and they are arguably holding steady, even as they're retaliating against us. And I think waiting for us to concentrate in Israel and then launch a knockout blow. They're not stupid. I don't think General Kellogg would have made it above the sergeant level in the Iranian army.
I think that's pretty clear too. It's interesting. People talk about President Trump, in fact, is one of them, but many in the media have that they killed some of our troops, and that's a red line. That's a red line for Trump, and he's going to bring holy hell down on top of them. But as you said a second ago, and just kind of point this out, in just the last few rounds of strikes here, U.S. military has killed at least 55 Iranians and wounded 645 others. One strike in particular, I think about 4 days ago, maybe five, killed 8 Iranian soldiers. So we're also killing their soldiers. And why do we think that the reaction that we have when we see American troops killed is not the same reaction that the Iranian side will have when they see their country being hit, not just their soldiers being killed, civilians being killed, bridges being knocked out, electric power generating sand, desalination plants, all that stuff? What do we think that, back to General Kellogg again, that is going to cause the Iranian nation? I wonder if you could talk to that a little bit about their culture and their 3,000 years of history. Is going to cause him to submit to us?
Well, I think we need to remember that we opened this war by killing 160 schoolgirls, you know, and that has become a rallying point for Iranian nationalism, as indeed the murder of their leader has. And we have pushed into power a group of people who are very nationalistic, not very theological, General Kellogg notwithstanding, and they are determined to defend the supreme national interest of their country, which is the same as the supreme national interest of any country, namely your national identity, your values, your history, your language, your political autonomy, your sovereignty. They are defending all these things against us. They didn't start this war. We did. And I think it is a bit strange that we don't have the minimal understanding of what murdering civilians, schoolgirls, as well as soldiers occasionally, other civilians, blowing up civilian infrastructure, which is a war crime, blowing up desal plants, which we've done. Now they're responding to us. And this is a game we can't win because our allies are where our bases are on the other side of the Persian Gulf cannot exist without desalinated water. They cannot exist without air conditioning. And in Kuwait is being really badly battered. It along with Bahrain, it is still home to some U.S. forces. In Bahrain, the forces have had to move to hotels, as they did initially in Qatar and the UAE, and now the Iranians are saying they're going to go after them there. So that is, civilians are going to die in large numbers as this thing goes forward, not just Iranians, but our Arab partners and Americans. So we started this war with the destruction of a lot of equipment. We did, and murdering the leadership in Iran. They started it by blowing out our $1.1 billion radar system in Qatar, with which we coordinated everything in the theater from Pakistan to Iraq. They've knocked out most of the THAAD radars, the Patriot radars. They've depleted in the first 5 days of this war, we ran through 80% of our Patriot inventory. They don't exist anymore. And the things that have been destroyed require anywhere from 2 to 4 or 5 years to replace, even with the increased production that the so-called War Department wants to pump into these arms manufacturers. So we're talking about weakening the United States for a period well beyond the second coming of Donald Trump. The next president's going to have to deal with the consequences of a much weaker U.S. military, much less capable.
You know, let me ask you a question here, because surely you and I are not the only two that can see this degradation in our capacity, this doublespeak, this sabotaging our own interests. And you might think that even somebody who's a political ally of the president who would otherwise like it because maybe they like some of his domestic programs or whatever, that there's a limit to where it's like, okay, if it's harming us, I mean, that's where I draw a line. I got to stand in. But, I mean, let me just show you this. This is from Senator Cotton. I guess this was yesterday. He said, well said, Senator Tim Shahey. From the hostage crisis to Khobar Towers, the Iranian regime has killed and maimed thousands of Americans. President Trump is right to finish the job. And as it should now be self-evident to even a neophyte who knows nothing about military affairs, we can't finish the job because we don't have the capacity, and they can outlast and deal more harm to us. Why then is somebody like Senator Cotton, who was once considered to be the Secretary of Defense, by the way, somebody who's supposed to know something about international affairs, is saying stuff like this that self-evidently can't be done?
Well, I mean, the allegation that the Iranians have killed thousands of Americans is utter nonsense. They once tried to kill me, by the way, but they missed. So here I am. But, you know, nobody said they were nice people in terms of the conduct of their foreign policy. But this doesn't justify what we're doing at all. And as you said, we can't finish the job because we've bungled it. We started this whole thing with a CIA Mossad organized rebellion in Iran, which resulted in the deaths of probably 3,000 civilians at the hands of the Iranian security forces. Anyway, it was put down brutally, whatever the number was, and it failed totally. We tried to get the Kurds to invade Iran, and they had the good sense not to do it. That failed completely. We then thought if we decapitated the regime, it would collapse. It has not. It has, in fact, remained, and in fact, in some ways, become stronger and more unified. We thought that if we punished the Iranian people, they would take out their anger on their government. But no, they take it out on us. And so this, from beginning to end, has been an amazing angle of misjudgments and ill-calculated actions. And now we have an administration and the people that you put on, Kellogg Keene and others, arguing for more of the same. The president's saying they need more of the same. Well, this is the definition of insanity. Something doesn't work, you just do more of it. Right. And what happens then? More of the same. So, you know, you want to keep this regime in power in Iran? We've just come up with the best way of all to do it. It's just like, you know, the Castro regime might not have survived in Cuba if we hadn't run the Bay of Pigs. But that unified Cubans behind the regime. And, you know, I mean, I remember that very well because I stumbled into the training camp in Guatemala where those guys were being trained, and I knew a lot of them when they got out, traded for tractors. So one other thing is going on in the region, and I want to mention it, and that is that the Houthis' fight with the Saudis is back on. And it's back on because the Saudis sponsor the internationally recognized government of Yemen, which is based in Aden in the south, Aden, and which has asserted its sovereign control of the airspace and therefore tried to prevent an Iranian aircraft from taking a Yemeni delegation from Ansar Allah, the Houthis, to Tehran for the funeral of the late Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. The Houthis say that was the Saudis who did that. The Saudis say, no, they didn't. The government in Aden, in the south of Yemen, has claimed credit for it. But anyway, the Houthis are blaming the Saudis, and they've shut down the strait to Saudi shipping, not to anyone else. But it's all a reminder of the fact that we spent $1 billion and a lot of naval power, a lot of weapons trying to subdue the Houthis when they blockaded the Red Sea for everyone in support of the Palestinians against Israel. And we failed. And so what did we do? We declared victory and sailed away. And maybe that's what we're going to have to do in the Strait of Hormuz. I don't see another solution.
Well, I don't see another good solution, but I just can't see Trump doing that. I mean, he had the golden opportunity to walk away and claim victory with the memorandum of understanding, is you know, complicated as that would be, and he sabotaged that. So it's hard for me to see where there is another Trump solution, since he already tried the agreement and it's talking about how they're evil, et cetera. Where can this go based on what you can see and this cast of players?
So the Iranians are very clear. They have always been clear about their demands. And they are now saying there will be no resumption of negotiations unless and until the memorandum of understanding, the terms of it, are implemented. That means no threats of the use of force, no use of force, no support for Israel in Lebanon, removing Israel from Lebanon, and it means allowing the Iranians to manage the Strait of Hormuz for 60 days as a negotiation ensues about long-term arrangements for that passageway from the Persian Gulf into the Gulf of Oman and the Arabian Sea. That's what it means. It also, by the way, included a $300 billion proposed fund for the reconstruction of Iran. My guess is that when there is a peace, as there will be, that the reconstruction is going to be financed by the Gulf Arabs, and they're not going to invest in the United States. They will have a stake in making peace with Iran so that Iran doesn't have an excuse to attack them again of the kind that we have engineered. You know, those bases in those countries were sold to them on the basis that we would defend them. And that was their defense against attack from Iraq, Iran, whoever. Those bases became attractive nuisances. They attracted attack rather than defended at all. And we have just demonstrated that we have no capacity to defend them. We don't even intend to defend them. Our priority is the defense of Israel, not them. So when they ask for recharge on the depleted musicians, we said, sorry, they have to go to Israel. So we've just totally destroyed our relationship with these countries. They are sticking with us for the moment because they have nowhere else to go. But the minute they have a chance to move away from us, they're going to. And you can see this sometimes in the behavior gutter of Saudi Arabia, and in particular, when they withhold use of their airspace, use of the facilities on their territory to support our aggression against Iran. They don't want to be a part of this.
And to what significance did you place on Saudi Arabia sending a delegation to the funeral of Ali Khamenei?
Well, they're obviously in constant diplomatic contact. They're talking about the post-war order. All of the Arabs are, you know, but they're not publicizing it. But, you know, the deputy foreign minister of Saudi Arabia was in Tehran not too long before this attack. And, you know, they are with Iraqi, Omani and Chinese help. They've patched it up with Iran. Now, Iran has been bombing them, bombing the bases in which they have allowed Americans to operate, specifically Prince Sultan Air Base in Al Kharij, which is south of Riyadh. That is where they destroyed a number of very expensive AWACS aircraft, which we can't really replace. They're about $500 million each. The Saudis are angry at the Iranians, yes, but they can be very cool-headed, they are not going to leave themselves in a position where they have forces on their territory that are attacking Iran and therefore getting counterattacked. From their point of view, the answer to this war is get rid of the American bases. And that's Iran's demand, and they will meet it, but not just now.
And last question is on Saudi Arabia. What is your understanding of how they're trying to mitigate the apparent closure of the Bab al-Mandab and the bottom part of the Red Sea? I understand they're trying to use some additional pipelines that already exist, but they're pretty much at max capacity already. So how long can Saudi Arabia have that shut off with the normal? It was like 4 to 7 million barrels a day were rolling through that. How are they going to mitigate this?
Most of the oil and gas is in the eastern provinces of Saudi Arabia, namely in the Persian Gulf region rather than the Red Sea region. There is a pipeline that goes from the Saudi east coast to the west coast to a port named Yanbu, which is an industrial city and port with refineries. And that has been used to export about 4.5 million barrels a day of oil through the Bab al-Mandab up to now. The result of the closure of the Bab al-Mandab to Saudi shipping or Saudi-related shipping, which, by the way, includes container ships going to Saudi Arabia, not just oil coming out, is that the Saudis are now forced to use the Suez Canal to get stuff out. And the Suez Canal cannot take the very large, super large tankers. So probably the amount of oil that Saudi is able to export has just fallen from, let's say, 4.5 to 5 million barrels a day to something like 2, maybe 1.5. So 2/3 of half of the Saudi oil exports have just been curtailed. That is very bad for Saudi Arabia, which is not in financial, wonderful financial condition. And of course, it's good for Saudi Arabia that oil prices are now over $100 a barrel, thanks to the latest outbreak of fighting. I think, by the way, that is a gross understatement of what oil actually costs if you look at futures prices. We are about to experience a crunch in the energy field. The Saudi oil that we import, we, of course, are a net exporter, but we have to import various grades of oil. Sour crude is essential to produce two things: diesel fuel, which is our trucking industry, and jet fuel, which is our transportation system other than trucking and automobiles. We're about to lose our supplies of both. So trucking is going to become vastly more expensive. That's going to add to inflation. And of course, as this chart shows, we had drawn down our strategic petroleum reserve to the point where we're near the bottom of the tank capabilities. You can't drain the tanks entirely or they become useless. So this is, you know, we're a week away from this maybe. And it isn't as though Donald Trump doesn't know this.
Yeah.
That's why he's behaving in a desperate fashion. But he doesn't have an answer. He's not going to get the Iranians to surrender under any circumstances, and they're not even going to come back to the negotiating table as long as we, in their view, don't keep our word.
And there's no evidence that's going to change anytime soon, so the outcome doesn't seem to be either. We'll have to wait and see where it's going to go, though. But we, as always, we are very grateful for your insights, especially your experience in the region, to share with us today. Thank you so much for that.
Well, thank you, Donnie.
And we appreciate you guys, too. Be sure to like and subscribe if you haven't on your way out. And we will continue tracking on this stuff. If anything happens over the weekend, like we have been up to this point, we'll certainly bring it to you. Otherwise, we'll see you on the next episode of the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. You know, I don't try to talk you into buying gold or tell you how to run your stock portfolio, but there is a way you can help us. Subscribe, hit that like button, and share this with somebody you love.